So, it is Saturday night. The clock has just struck 10 p.m.
Oh boy.
Yeah. You've just finished feeding like 12 of your closest and maybe most complicated extended family
Right.
members. And you are staring at a dining room that basically looks like a war zone of crumpled napkins and sticky plates.
Just absolute chaos.
Total chaos. And then the realization hits you. You have exactly 14 hours before you have to do this entire thing all over again.
It is the ultimate test of hosting endurance. I mean, truly.
It really is, because this isn't just some hypothetical nightmare. This is the exact, very real gauntlet facing anyone who is hosting Rosh Hashanah in 2026.
Yeah, it's a big one this year.
Welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. We are digging into this incredibly insightful strategy breakdown from Leila Farahani. She's a cultural celebration specialist at Party Boutiques over in Thornhill, Ontario.
Which is such a great source, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. And our mission for you today is to extract the absolute best, stress-saving secrets to efficiently manage a mega hosting weekend. We're going to look at how to save your time, optimize your money, and most crucially, preserve your sanity when the calendar is, well, actively working against you.
Because the calendar really is the main antagonist in this specific scenario.
Oh, totally.
There is this fascinating quirk happening in 2026. So Rosh Hashanah begins at sundown on Friday, September 11th. And because it starts on a Friday, the holiday runs straight into Shabbat.
Which is just wow.
Right. There is no ordinary weekday in between to catch your breath. You can't run the dishwasher. You can't reset the house. It just keeps going seamlessly until nightfall on Sunday, September 13th.
Which means if you are the house where everyone gathers, you are looking at four massive festive meals back to back.
Four.
You've got Friday night dinner, Saturday lunch, Saturday night dinner, and Sunday lunch. I mean, in a normal year, you'd only be setting the table three times, which, let's be honest, is already a lot.
It's exhausting.
But four. I am genuinely exhausted just thinking about the sheer volume of dirty dishes.
Well, yeah, and it is entirely overwhelming if you approach it the way you would a standard single evening dinner party.
Right.
The traditional hosting playbook completely falls apart under this kind of pressure. But that is exactly what we are going to deconstruct for you today.
Yes.
We're looking at the exact logistics needed, not just to survive this calendar overlap, but to actually thrive, be present and enjoy the holiday with your family.
Okay, so let's unpack this because the calendar dictates this relentless pace. The very first domino that falls is usually the kitchen,
Oh, always the kitchen.
specifically the turnaround time between meals. Because the window between Saturday lunch wrapping up and Saturday dinner beginning is incredibly narrow.
It's basically non-existent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to spend that tiny window of rest standing at the sink scrubbing gravy off of heavy ceramic plates.
No, absolutely not. And this is where we have to fundamentally shift our mindset about holiday tableware.
Okay, tell me about that.
So the most strategic move here is to rely on high-quality disposable tableware instead of trying to wash up between every single service.
Which makes sense.
It does, but some people might instantly balk at that. There is this ingrained idea that disposables aren't formal enough for a major holiday, that it somehow, I don't know, cheapens the ritual.
Right, there's that hosting guilt. We feel like if we aren't sweating over fine china, we just aren't honoring the guests.
But what's fascinating here is the underlying philosophy of energy management.
Energy management, I like that.
Yeah, because if you spend your only 2 hours of downtime washing dishes, you are going to be miserable and exhausted for the evening meal.
For sure.
And if the host is completely drained, the atmosphere of the entire holiday suffers. The tension literally radiates across the table. So it's not about cutting corners, it's about strategically allocating your energy so you can actually be a warm, welcoming presence.
I love that framing. It's like you're running a pop-up restaurant, but you are the head chef, the maitre d', and the dishwashing staff all rolled into one.
All of it, yeah.
You have to adapt the tools to the reality of your labor force. So how do we do this without it feeling like a generic paper plate picnic?
Well, you build efficiency into the fabric of the event by understanding what guests actually interact with.
Okay.
For example, you buy packs of high-quality disposables once. You can find these beautiful, thick, good Yom Tov gold stamp napkins.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and a pack is 16 costs, like under $8, and that single purchase covers your whole weekend. But the real magic is in how you layer the table to keep costs down while still refreshing the aesthetic.
Yes, this concept absolutely blew my mind when I was reading through our sources. So you want each of the four meals to feel distinct,
right?
You don't want your guests to feel like they are trapped in Groundhog Day. So the secret is that you leave the shared centerpieces, like your floral arrangement or your honey pot, on the table all weekend long.
Don't move them.
Right. You do not touch the middle of the table. You only swap out the tactile layer.
The elements the guests physically touch.
Exactly. So for the second night, Saturday evening, you might spend $10 total on a fresh set of colored napkins and new place cards.
And that's it.
Yeah. And suddenly, the Saturday evening table feels like a completely different, refreshed experience. But you didn't have to do a massive second shopping trip, and you certainly didn't have to redesign the whole room.
It's so smart. And if we look at the base layer, the tablecloth itself, there's another brilliant cost-saving insight here.
Oh, yeah, the plastic covers.
Right. Disposable plastic table covers are cheap, usually around $2 to $5, depending on if you get white or metallic gold. But if you already own a good, reusable, spill-proof tablecloth,
just use that.
Exactly. Skip the disposable covers entirely. Take that money you just saved and redirect it to the centerpiece.
Because you aren't spending your weekend scrubbing plates, you actually have the mental bandwidth to think about the design of the table.
Exactly.
But, okay, how do you decorate without ending up with a bunch of expensive, highly specific junk that you just have to store in your garage for the next 12 months?
The classic trap.
Right. This is where the strategy gets really smart. The advice here is not to decorate by theme, but to decorate by time.
Yes, this is a vital paradigm shift. Usually when people plan a party, they pick a visual theme, say golden white elegance or autumn harvest, and just buy a bunch of stuff that fits that description and scatter it everywhere.
Right, just throw leaves all over the table.
Exactly. But a Rosh Hashanah table is not a static display. It is a very specific job to do at specific minutes of the evening.
Wait, hold on. Decorating down to the minute? That sounds incredibly intense.
It sounds like a lot, I know.
Yeah, it sounds like I'm directing a stage play instead of just hosting my cousins for dinner. Doesn't choreographing the table add more stress?
It sounds theatrical, yes, but the ritual itself is inherently theatrical.
Oh, that's fair.
Think about the simanim. These are the symbolic foods eaten at the start of the Rosh Hashanah meal. You have the apples and honey for a sweet year, the round shalah representing the cycle of the year, pomegranates for abundance.
And depending on your family's background, this sequence of blessings can take up a lot of physical space.
A ton of space.
Right, because a Sephardic or Mizrahi family might have a full seder of simanim, which includes dates, leeks, beets, and a fish head. That is a lot of separate dishes.
Exactly. Each of those items requires its own specific blessing and its own plate. So the table isn't just sitting there looking pretty. It has to function as the stage for these rituals.
Right.
If your table is covered in random, themeless scatter, like, you know, faux autumn leaves and giant decorative gourds, there is literally no physical room for the dates or the leeks.
You're just moving pumpkins out of the way to eat.
Exactly. Form has to follow function.
Okay. That makes perfect sense. The decor has to serve the ritual, not crowd it out. So let's walk through this temporal journey, kind of experiencing the table the way a guest would.
Let's do it.
So layer one happens the moment they walk into the dining room before anyone even sits down. This is your first impression. You have your table cover. White or gold metallic is a great bright base. And then a very thin scatter of gold star of David confetti down the center.
Which is great because it provides instant festivity without taking up functional square footage.
But there is a crucial warning from the experts behind the counter at party boutiques. Do not overbuy the confetti.
Oh, yeah.
A thin scatter down the center is elegant. If you dump two whole packs on the table, it suddenly looks like a 13-year-old's bar mitzvah party.
It really does. It's a classic rookie mistake. More is not always more, especially when you need that space later.
So that's the initial visual impact.
Yeah.
Then we move to the action center. As the meal begins, the guest's focus narrows to one specific moment. The moment the apple goes into the honey.
The main event.
Exactly. It is the emotional peak of the table and honestly the most photographed object of the night. So a beautiful glass hexagon honey pot with a wooden dipper, which might cost around $15, does way more visual and emotional work than $50 of random scattered decor.
It anchors the entire experience. But there is a fascinating behavioral insight to consider regarding that central honeypot.
Oh, what's that?
Well, imagine a long table of 11 people. The ritual begins. Are 11 people going to awkwardly reach across the table, across their family members, sequentially dipping their individual apple slices into one single shared pot?
Oh gosh, I can picture the chaos now. The dripping honey, people's sleeves getting dragged through the hummus and the salad.
It's a disaster.
It's a logistical nightmare that completely ruins the elegance of the moment.
It really does. So the strategic fix here is the dipper strategy.
Okay, the dipper strategy.
Right. Instead of forcing everyone to share, you provide individual dippers for every guest. You can easily find small silver or gold ones in packs of four for under $8.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Giving everyone their own dipper turns a chaotic, sticky bottleneck into a seamless, elegant ritual. It solves a functional problem while making the table feel incredibly intentional and designed.
So we've set the stage, we've anticipated the functional needs of the ritual, but what happens when the extended family actually arrives, takes off their coats, and walks toward the dining room?
The human element.
Right. This brings us to the actual guest experience. And here is where we get into some profound human psychology. The strongest recommendation is to use place cards.
Yes. Highly recommend.
You can get a dozen beautiful little honeybee cards for around $5. But okay, let's be honest. Isn't assigned seating at a family holiday a little too formal?
It feels like it would be.
Yeah. These are your aunts and uncles, not diplomats at a state dinner. Doesn't it kill the relaxed, homey vibe?
Yeah, it's a very common concern, but this is one of those counterintuitive truths about group dynamics. Structure actually creates relaxation. Think about the reality of an extended family holiday. You are bringing together people who might only see each other twice a year. There are complex family dynamics, unspoken histories, and maybe some mild awkwardness.
The classic, who sits next to Uncle Gary dilemma.
Precisely. When guests walk into a room with open seating, they immediately experience a spike in decision fatigue and micro-stress.
Oh, for sure.
They're thinking, where do I sit? Am I taking someone's spot? Do I want to be near the kitchen or the head of the table?
Yeah.
By using place cards, you completely eliminate that awkward hovering in the hallway.
Right.
You take the burden of choice away from the guest, allowing them to immediately settle in and feel taken care of.
I can completely see that. You are preemptively removing friction before the first glass of wine is even poured.
Exactly.
And then, once they do sit down, there's a brilliant secret to making the whole setup look expensive, even if you are using disposable plates.
Oh, love this tip.
The secret to a quote-unquote designed table isn't the plate at all, it's the napkin ring.
Yes, it acts as the visual anchor at the individual seat.
Exactly. You can pick up beautiful apple or pomegranate-shaped rings, and they work out to maybe 50 cents a guest.
Which is nothing.
Right. For literal pennies, a napkin ring carries the entire theme of the holiday directly to every single seat. It elevates a paper napkin into a deliberate design choice. But while we are talking about guests, we have to talk about the demographic that couldn't care less about your 50-cent pomegranate napkin rings.
The kids.
The kids.
Yes.
Yeah.
The ultimate stress test of any holiday meal.
First-time hosts almost always forget this, but veteran hosts know the golden rule. You have to plan for the children separately. Do not expect an 8-year-old to sit quietly for 2 hours admiring your glass hexagon honeypot.
Because they absolutely will not. Their tolerance for adult conversation and prolonged rituals is, understandably, very low.
Zero tolerance. So you proactively manage this. You invest in Rosh Hashanah or Sukkot-themed coloring sets, which are usually around $8. You buy the puffy stickers for $4.
Yes, the puffy stickers.
Over a massive four-meal weekend, keeping the kids busy, entertained, and quietly engaged right at the table buys you more peace than any elaborate centerpiece ever could.
It is an investment in tranquility.
Absolutely.
And there is a great piece of what not to do advice for setting the ambiance as well. Skip the balloon walls.
Oh, really?
Yeah. As tempting as it might be to create a big, trendy visual moment, a massive wall of balloons is the wrong energy for this specific holiday.
The ambiance needs to match the intention.
Exactly. It's a multi-course dinner centered around ancient rituals, you know. It's not a milestone birthday party.
Yeah.
You want the warmth of candlelight and an elegantly set table, not a loud, overwhelming focal wall that belongs at a baby shower.
Speaking of timing and intention, there is a major scheduling curveball we have to talk about for this specific 2026 weekend.
Right.
We mentioned the four meals, but the final meal, Sunday lunch, has a unique cultural rhythm that hosts really need to anticipate, right?
Yes, and understanding this will save the host so much unnecessary anxiety.
Okay, lay it on us.
So, on the afternoon of the first day of Rosh Hashanah, there is a beautiful custom called Tashlish. This involves walking to a body of natural flowing water and casting breadcrumbs into it, symbolizing the casting away of sins from the previous year.
Right.
Traditionally, this happens on the first day.
But because the first day in 2026 falls on Shabbat, things change.
Correct. Mm-hmm. On Shabbat, carrying items outside of certain boundaries isn't permitted in many observant communities, so the Tashlish ritual is moved to the second day, which is Sunday.
So how does that affect the person sitting at home trying to time a brisket for Sunday lunch?
Well, if you are hosting that fourth meal, you need to expect your guests to arrive much later than they normally would.
Ah, okay.
Because instead of coming straight from synagogue services, many groups will walk to local parks, creeks, or waterfronts first to perform Tashlish.
Right.
If you don't anticipate this delay, you will be sitting by the window, stressed out that your food is drying out,
there.
And silently fuming that your guests are being rude.
Just simmering in resentment.
Exactly. But if you know the cultural rhythm of the day, you can adjust your cooking times and keep your sanity intact.
That is the ultimate insider knowledge. You have to know the cultural rhythms, not just the store inventory.
Exactly.
So we have the menu timed. We have the decor mapped out by the guest's temporal journey. We've preempted the seating awkwardness. We've pacified the kids with puffy stickers. And we're mentally prepared for a late Sunday lunch.
We're looking pretty good.
We are. But how does this all scale? When the RSVPs actually start rolling in, how do we manage the budget? Let's talk about the economics of table size, because the math here is fascinating.
The economics of hosting are rarely linear. Most people assume that every additional guest adds a fixed cost, but it is much more dynamic than that.
It really is. So let's look at a full place setting. If you buy the works, a decorative charger plate, the dinner plate, the napkin, the ring, the place card, the individual dipper, it might cost around $11 per guest. If you have a table for eight, including your shared centerpieces, you are looking at roughly $130 for the table setup, which for a major holiday is pretty reasonable.
It is a solid baseline, but flexibility is key.
Right. So if you need to cut costs quickly, the easiest thing to drop is the large decorative charger plate sitting under the dinner plate.
Oh, for sure.
That saves you about $4 a person right off the bat. And visually, if you just have a crisp white table cover with a beautiful gold dinner plate resting directly on it, no one even notices the charger is missing.
Because they're looking at the food anyway.
Right. And suddenly your per guest setting drops to around $7.
It's all about knowing where the visual impact really lies. You don't need layer upon layer of plastic to make it look elegant.
Exactly. But here's the part of the strategy that totally changed how I look at event planning. It's the concept of the 12 guest trap.
Oh, this is a brilliant observation about the physical spatial constraints of hosting.
Okay, let me see if I can break this down because it took me a second to grasp it. 12 is actually the absolute worst, most expensive number of guests you can possibly invite.
It really is.
And it isn't because of the food. It's because of the furniture.
Exactly. Walk us through the math.
Okay, so at 8 or 10 guests, you can usually squeeze everyone around one standard extended dining table.
Right. Everyone's at one table.
You perfectly fill that one table, which means you only need one table cover and one set of centerpieces. But the moment you hit 12 guests, you physically run out of room.
You're out of chairs.
You are forced to cross over and set up a second folding table.
And that second table demands its own ecosystem.
Yes. The moment you set up table number two, you have to buy a second table cover. You have to buy a second $15 honey pot so the people at the new table can actually reach the apples.
Right.
You have to buy a second floral arrangement. But here is the kicker. You are only putting two or four people at that second table. It is half empty.
So much wasted space.
Because of all that dead space and the duplicated centerpieces, your per guest cost spikes massively.
It's terribly inefficient.
Yeah.
You are paying for the infrastructure of a much larger party without the people to fill it.
It is bizarre bulk math. So the solution is twofold. Either you ruthlessly tighten the guest list, cut it down to 10, and just happily squeeze everyone onto one table, or you do the exact opposite. You invite more people.
You scale up to scale down.
Exactly. If you increase your guest list from 12 up to maybe 18 or 20 people, your per head average drops right back down.
Because you've already spent the money.
Right. You've already paid for the expensive surfaces. You already bought the second table cover and the second honeypot. You might as well fill those empty chairs to spread out the cost of the decor.
What you've just articulated is the golden rule of event design decorations and hosting costs scale with surfaces. not with headcount.
Wow. Yeah.
It's the physical space, the square footage of the tables, that dictates the decor budget far more than the number of mouths you're feeding.
That is huge.
Once you understand that you are decorating surfaces, not people, you can control the budget rather than letting a random RSVP list control you.
Surfaces, not headcount. That is a total paradigm shift for anyone who throws dinner parties.
It really is.
So, as we wrap up this deep dive into surviving the four-meal marathon, let's summarize the ultimate toolkit we've just built for you.
Let's do it.
If you are staring down the barrel of the 2026 Rosh Hashanah calendar quirk, here is your game plan. First, give yourself permission to leverage quality disposables to save your kitchen, save your energy, and preserve the welcoming vibe of your home.
Absolutely. Second, decorate based on the evening's actual timeline and functional rituals rather than a static generic theme.
Let form follow function. Third, do not forget to invest in tranquility. Buy the puffy stickers and the coloring sets for the kids so the adults can actually enjoy the salmon.
Please do not forget the puffy stickers.
And finally, beware the 12 guest trap. Manage your table surfaces and the budget will naturally fall into place. With these strategies, you aren't just surviving a holiday marathon, you are equipped to host it like a seasoned pro.
You can navigate the exhaustion and actually find the joy in the gathering.
Absolutely. But before we go, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. Think back to that massive extended family dinner we talked about at the very beginning.
The war zone.
Yeah, the war zone. We spent this entire time dissecting practical constraints. The quirky overlap of the lunar calendar. The physical dimensions of a folding table. The utter dread of washing dishes at 10 p.m. on a Saturday night.
The unglamorous realities of hosting.
Right. But consider how those very mundane practical constraints actually shape our cultural aesthetics and our deepest traditions. Mm. Does the sheer necessity of using paper plates or deploying coloring books to keep a six-year-old quiet make a holiday feel less authentic? Or does adapting to these constraints represent the very real, very beautiful evolution of how modern families actually survive and celebrate together?
That's a great point.
It is something to think about the next time you sit down to a perfectly timed, strategically disposable, and wonderfully chaotic holiday meal.
For sure.
Until next time.